From Bigfoot to ghosts, aliens to the afterlife, this is Nightcast. And now, here is your host, Ian Morris.
Welcome to the night. It's a dark night on the island tonight. Only a crescent moon is out over the Pacific as I look through the studio window. Dark nights remind me of a house I once lived in. As well as my family and myself, something else was occupying our home. Many strange things happened in that house, most I cannot rationally explain. What was causing chairs to move, dishes to clatter, and many other things I hesitate to tell you about? Tonight on Nightcast, we have very special guests to help answer some of those questions, to tell true stories of their paranormal investigations, and they've even brought us some EVPs, electronic voice phenomena, as evidence. They are from the Thames Society of Paranormal Investigations. Their mission is to research, investigate, educate, and provide assistance to those who are experiencing paranormal phenomena. Based in Connecticut, they travel throughout New England and beyond in search of the supernatural. The group conducts confidential and objective investigations. They strive for tangible, measurable evidence to provide their clients with answers. Joining us on Nightcast this evening from Connecticut, Seamus Denniston, director, founder, and lead investigator, and Stephanie Sutera, associate director, photographer, senior investigator from the Thames Society of Paranormal Investigations. Seamus, Stephanie, welcome to Nightcast.
Oh, thanks for having us on.
Yes, we're excited.
Now, the Thames Society of Paranormal Investigations, how long has your organization been around?
Our organization has been around since 2010. So we've roughly been around a little over 5 years, coming up on our sixth year here. And the team is kind of comprised of people with previous experience. And I had prior experience in working with a couple of other teams. And in 2010, we founded the team.
And what was your background in the paranormal?
My interest in the paranormal started a long time ago. I grew up in a haunted house as a child. And so that piqued my interest from an early age. And as I got older, I found some friends that had mutual interest in the paranormal, and they said they had a team and they're looking for people to kind of round out their team, and that's kind of how I got started.
And Stephanie, what about your background?
Well, I was not there for the actual beginnings of TSPI, but I joined about 6 months in, and I mean, my paranormal background grew from a really early age, just like Seamus. But it was more, I had just an interest in like horror movies and, you know, watching Scooby-Doo when I was a young kid. And then I would go to the library and I would always check out books that would tell people's true life stories about like real hauntings. I mean, I enjoyed the fiction as well, but that just fascinated me. And when I was in high school, I had a friend that was really, really close to me, and I would frequent her house a lot, and her home was particularly active, and I had a lot of crazy stuff happen to me in that house, and it really made me, you know, wonder what the heck is going on. Like, I'm certainly not seeing things that it's happening to their family as well, so, like, what's going on? And as I got a little bit older, I ended up knowing our co-founder, Todd Radley. And he had posted on his Facebook that they were looking for people. And I was so ecstatic about finding out what was going on. I mean, I knew I had a basic knowledge of the paranormal, but I needed to know more. Joined the group. So, like I said, I've been there about 6 months in, and I'm not going anywhere anytime soon, that's for sure.
Well, how did your investigative group come together?
Well, like I said before, I was with a couple other teams for a period of time. And I just was kind of, there was a lack of follow through, to say the least. And the focus with those teams is that it was like thrill seeking, right? And that really wasn't it for me. Like, of course, I enjoy doing this and I enjoy my curiosity about the paranormal. But I found that there was times that people were calling us into their homes and stuff, and there was no closure. We were just going, telling people spirit. And there was really no follow through. There was no follow up. And ultimately, we weren't helping the people. So that inspired me to kind of go out and do things my own way. And also there were some things, and flaws in maybe investigation techniques or things that just didn't make sense to me for whatever reason.
You're located in Connecticut. Where in Connecticut are you located?
We're based out of southeastern Connecticut. For those folks, you know, maybe from Hawaii, they have Navy bases. We got a big submarine naval base here in the southeastern Connecticut area, the Groton, New London area.
Right. I'm familiar with that. How many people are in your investigative group?
I think we're at 10.
Now, do you investigate full time?
No. I mean, we all have jobs and families or school. It's not as if we take a break. We are always getting cases all the time, and we try to do as many as we can.
What is your criteria for taking on an investigation?
Well, number one, the person really has to have a need and they need help. Typically, those are home cases. There's a few cases that may be a business or a private location that ask for assistance, and you know, we'll take those too. Our bread and butter is basically home cases where people really need help, and it's usually some sort of distress or, you know, something frightening going on to some people living in their home. So we usually the criteria for that is there's a screening process, of course, that starts with initial interview, you know, maybe over the phone or something informal. We'll meet for coffee and we'll talk over what's going on. And then the second stage is I'll send out a group of investigators that usually a pair, either myself or a couple other team members that I designate to do that. And they'll do like a formal interview, sit down and go through everything. We'll usually record the interview. We'll do a walkthrough of the premises and things like that. And at that point, we pretty much know whether or not we're going to take the case.
Seamus, Stephanie, what works and what doesn't work when investigating hauntings?
Like the actual, like when we're in a session or just our dealings with the clients?
When you are in a session, when you are investigating, what works, what doesn't work? How do you elicit a response? And what would you do that would not elicit a response, that would be completely ridiculous that you see other groups doing?
Screaming at them is for one. I don't ever find you just sit there berating whatever that you may, an entity or you're talking to the air or whatever. I find that is never helpful, ever. I guess some people call that provoking, but there's degrees of provoking that is effective in the right circumstances and depending on the situation. But I don't, never to the point where you're cussing or swearing or being disrespectful in any way. I don't find that ever being helpful. But it's to answer your question about what works, what doesn't work. Sometimes what works on one case works fantastic. In another case, you try the same technique and it's not working. So you kind of have to tailor your techniques to the situation. And you know, you got to constantly be reevaluating while you're doing the investigation to see, well, this didn't work. So let's tweak it. Let's see if we do this or we change. You know, there's many dynamics there. Maybe it's a certain team member that will, that night will get a lot of the evidence or will be able to capture or get a illicit response. So it constantly evolves throughout the investigation.
And that's sort of why we have some lead investigators too. They sort of assess how things are going. And if maybe something is gravitating towards one of our members, well, why don't we use that as a tool and put that person, you know, in the next session again. So maybe we will start getting activity, or maybe our medium could be getting some fantastic readings and we're actually, you know, we're using the spirit box and we're getting very intelligent responses through that because they're interacting with, and you know, it's kind of corresponding with what she's going with. So like you said, we're sort of gathering all the information and then as we go along, sort of building on the night. I mean, we always go in it with a certain way we set up everything, but how the investigation plays out, that's sort of surprising.
Now, what percentage of your hauntings are hostile hauntings?
Very few. Very few, I find. I've only maybe been on three or four cases, and as long as I've been doing this, where I felt it was hostile.
I sometimes think that people also sort of confuse the hostility with mischievous, because a lot of people will have things broken or knocked over and may interpret it as something negative, where it's just kind of playing a game with you or, you know.
And it, you throw in that dynamic, it depends a lot on the client's perception of things. We had a home case. It was an immigrant family from Ecuador, and their cultural perception of what the paranormal is and spirits and things like that, kind of qualified everything that was happening to them. So they automatically assumed it's got to be some sort of negative demonic presence in their home and things like that. And a lot of times, you know, like Stephanie said, spirits are kind of being overzealous in trying to make contact, and people misconstrue that as being aggressive or hostile towards them.
Well, Seamus, Stephanie, is it the person that is being haunted or is it the location?
Both.
Yeah, it's possible that it's both. Or, you know, there's always that they're attached to an item that is within the home as well. So, you know, that's kind of one of the reasons why we go in there. Sometimes you can assess by, like, the activity or the claims that kind of gravitates towards an individual. Because we had a case not that long ago that everything that had happened in the home happened to a specific person. But when we did the investigation, they kind of just left us in the home and nothing happened to us the whole night. So, I mean, it's either there's not much going on or it could possibly be just attracted to that specific person and it has to do with them. So that would be time where we would want to go back in and have that individual go back with us and try again to see if maybe it's either something it's attached to him or if it's just something he keeps seeing things that aren't there.
Seamus, are people hesitant to tell you sometimes about activity that happens in their home?
If I would say in general, the general public, people I know typically are. People that call us usually, let's say for home cases, those people are typically very forthcoming about what's happening to them because they're very confused. And a lot of times we're getting contacted by people that this is the first time they've ever experienced anything unusual happen to them.
Well,
and so they're quite disturbed by what's going on.
I lived at one time in an entity occupied home, and I divulged a little bit about it on another show. And there was a lot of activity, and I talked about it a little bit in the introduction. Dishes would clatter, chairs would move. At one point, and this I brought up in one of our past shows, I was a police officer at the time, and a quarter flew off the dresser across the room and hit my name tag on my uniform as if to insult me and dropped on the floor. It culminated many, many things. I can't bring them all up, but it culminated with me actually seeing the entity. And how that occurred was I had purchased a motorcycle and I was going to get up and ride the next morning. And it was about 11:30 on a Saturday night. I decided to go and take one last look before I went to bed, you know, typical guy thing. And I went into the kitchen, opened the door that led into the garage. Before I could turn on the light, I saw a guy standing behind my motorcycle looking down at it. He looked up at me. I looked at him. His eyes got wide and he took off. I slammed the door. I went and got my service weapon and went out to search the garage. When I went out there and searched the garage, there was absolutely nothing there. The door from the back, which led to the outside, can only lock from the inside. And it was locked. There was nothing there. So I started thinking about what I saw. And what I saw was a guy standing there in a red plaid shirt. And when he looked at me and I looked at him, he took off. And as I started to recollect, he didn't have a bottom half to him. When the when he took off, the bottom half was like a wisp of smoke. Now, this is the first time I've told anybody outside my family and my neighbor. Do you hear things like that frequently?
Oh, absolutely. I think you and I share a similar experience because not only you said you're a former police officer, my father was too. And my dad would kind of keep to himself about what was going on in the house. But at a point when I reached maybe 15, 16 years old, it was pretty obvious we had a spirit in the home and he had a personal experience. And this spirit was particularly, I would call it a mimic. It could mimic. So if you were in my home for any length of time, a couple of weeks later, it could reproduce your voice and make it sound like you were in the house. We thought that was really weird. It culminated with my father being home because at that point he had a home office and the distinct sound of the garage door opening and putting the various doors into the house. He was in his office. He actually heard that. So he figured my mother was home from a shopping trip and came out of his office and investigated how everything was secure. And he went back to his office, but he was a little leery. He's like, all right, well, he kind of shook it off. He went back to his his office, and then he heard the noise again, the garage door opening, the doors subsequently opening behind each other, and he didn't get up this time. And he was a police officer, and he had a firearm in his desk. He took it out to investigate, you know, there's somebody in my home possibly. And at that point, someone stood in front of his office door. It was about a 6 foot, he described about a 6 foot three shadow man with no definition. He was just a black silhouette of a person, stood in front of him and looked at him into his office, and then walked into the house. So obviously he gave a chase and through the house, and he didn't really tell us too much about that, but it took him by surprise. He was actually standing in the driveway when we came home from the shopping trip, and he explained what had happened. He was pretty shooken up about
incredible
that.
Incredible stories. Well, Seamus, Stephanie, we have to pause for a break. When we return, we'll ask Seamus and Stephanie more about their paranormal investigations, and we'll listen to EVPs, electronic voice phenomena. Seamus, Stephanie, and I will be on the other side of the break. I'm Ian Morris. Stay with us. We'll be back.
This is Nightcast.
Welcome back to Nightcast. I'm Ian Morris. You can get all the news throughout the Pacific throughout the night on Overnight Pacific News, following Nightcast on your local 3N network station. Our guests joining us this evening from Connecticut, Seamus Denniston and Stephanie Sotera of the Thames Society of Paranormal Investigations. Stephanie, Seamus, have you ever had an investigation that you found to be a hoax?
I don't think anybody's purposely tried to mislead us with some sort of speakers or what have you, or ways to try to trick us. I think they've given us phony stories and kind of wasted our time.
Making them seem more active than they were, just for the thrill of having a paranormal investigation team come into your house, which I understand is fun.
Yeah, I had a private location too that kind of just talked up what was going on in order to boost business.
Well, what kind of investigations do you do?
Well, we do everything. I mean, we are primarily in the business to help people. So that does bring on a lot of home cases. But we are also really into being an educational team as well. So sometimes we do historical locations, but they're not the type of people who are looking for the thrill. They are genuinely curious as to what is going on in their establishment. That way, and it's a great way for us to be able to research, you know, continue our research as well. So that's also like really, really nice. Like we've had a place called the Denniston Homestead that we did kind of a public event with them too. After we did a couple investigations with them, so that way we could kind of let everybody know our story, and then we got to, you know, show them where things happen, and it was really great, and people were super duper interested in it. And then we also gave them kind of a rundown of the process and the instruments that we use. And I like that, because all people ever see is what's on the television, and you know, they don't get the real experience on how people are going about doing it and how much work that we put into all of it.
Now, what procedures do you do before you perform an investigation?
Like Seamus said before, we do the interviews. Like, we have a preliminary phone interview, and then we do the actual one. But when we go into, before we, you know, the night of the investigation, we do an entire thorough background check on the home. And then we sort of base some of that around the claims that we are given by the client, and see if we can maybe get a documented understanding of the place before we go there. So if you're going to libraries and the town hall and talking to the historians in the area that are kind of the experts, because you always find in like certain towns, there will be somebody who's just, you know, well, this was an area there were a lot of factories in, and this person you can go to, and they just know more than you can find on the web or in any books. They just happen to have all these magical facts that kind of you just can't find.
Especially with home cases, there's that. And when we say background check, obviously, as Stephanie says, we do a historical inquiry. But I think as a former police officer, you can appreciate that the initial interview and you sit down with a client is the huge of what we do, because not only are we analyzing, we have to analyze, you know, are they telling us the truth? You know, can their stories be corroborated?
Are there underlying factors?
The underlying factors, is their family issues going on in the home? What's the reason? You know, I really kind of try to take the standpoint of, and it's not a disrespectful way, it's I try to catch them lying. You talk to them and you just let them talk, and you take copious amounts of notes, and you know, you look for various indicators about what's going on here that could lead to this. And because ultimately we don't want to waste our time, for one, and two, we don't want to be helping perpetuate a hoax, and three, we want to make sure when we bring a team into their home, all my team members are going to be safe, and we're not bringing them into some sort of environment where it's not an unhealthy one. There's a lot of work goes into that.
Why do entities stick around or get stuck?
That's probably more case by case. I mean, I'm sure you always hear something tragic happened and that's why they ended up getting stuck here. But I mean, I feel, especially when we've done like theaters, you have either it's like a place that they thoroughly enjoyed and love to be at, or, I mean, you have to think like a place like a theater, an actor or a singer is, I mean, in order to really portray any character, you are emitting so much energy out of your body and so much emotion. There's no reason why it shouldn't kind of leave an impression in time, or make it some of the, you know, the like one of the fondest places that you've ever been. And I mean, I sometimes don't even think that it has really to do with necessarily that you died there, because there's just, maybe it's a frequent, maybe that's where you just gravitated to. And that's one of the reasons why we do this, because you're trying to make all those connections and figure it out. Like, why did you stay?
Well, do hauntings go on forever?
I don't think so. I think in some cases, I think it basically, and one of our team members said it best, and I like to use it. I think we're quantifying energy, ultimately, and that will peter out over time, and maybe there's more energy, it will last longer. But I also think environmental conditions play a big factor in how long a haunting may take place, and if it even will.
It can also sort of remain dormant, where there's just not as much activity because there's nothing going on in the home. Because sometimes you'll have, like, I lived in a home at the last place that I lived, and there was activity, claims of activity from the previous people that lived there, and speaking with the owner's son, like they lived there when they were younger, and there was a lot of stuff. And I never really saw anything until we started to move out. And that's when things, like strange things started happening, things that I just put something there and now it's not there anymore. Or I'd see something walk past in the hallway and I'm like, okay, I never have seen any of these things. So I assumed that all the claims were nothing. So I really thoroughly believe that things can remain dormant until something is disrupted or something happens. And like those conditions are just right.
Have either of you ever felt any physical evidence, like a touch, while investigating?
Oh, yeah. I've had my hair pulled and played with, and I always get touched and stuff. And I mean, not on our investigation, but that home that I talked about, at one point it had my shoulder squeezed. So it was not something that I was unfamiliar with, that I would be physically, have physical contact with whatever I'm contacting.
How do you elicit a response from an entity?
Well, but part of it, like I said, there's a lot of different ways you can do it. But I think with a general attitude going in towards it and expressing respect and positivity and explaining why you're here and what you're doing there and that you're not there to harm anyone or make them leave, I find that to be overall, as an overall strategy, to be effective.
Out of how many recordings that you do you actually get an EVP?
Hours and hours and hours.
I mean, well, investigation is not getting any, so that's a good eight.
Do you you enhance your EVPs?
Amplify. I would sometimes turn it up to try to see if you can hear. We try not to take anything out of recordings or take anything away from a recording, because I think the more you remove noise, I mean, there's certain filters you can throw things through and tweak it. But like I said, I don't really like to remove anything from an actual raw recording, because you don't know what you're taking away. And if you take away too much, then you may be just looking or hearing something.
So what you really want to do is that you always keep the raw file, and then if, like, let's say you're going to reveal it to a client, some of the evidence that you've collected, we will enhance it and use it and give it to them too. But that's just so if they're like, well, I'm not really hearing it, and then they hear an enhanced version of it, they're like, okay, well, I hear that now. And now they can go back to the raw and be like, they pinpointed the exact area where they're hearing it, because it is hard sometimes, because it is such a low volume, and if you are not used to picking that stuff up. So it's not like everything we have, well, we only give enhanced stuff, so it, like, we do have both, but it's like, always make sure we have that raw.
It's important, and she brings up a good point, is that we're trained and we know what to look for.
You've brought us some EVPs tonight.
Yes.
To listen to. And we're going to go ahead and listen to the first one. Tell us about the Avery Kopp House.
Well, it's located in Groton, Connecticut. It's along the Thames River there. It overlooks it. It's got a varied history in it. And people from southeastern Connecticut know that shoreline there had a lot of historical significance. We actually had a Revolutionary War battle there in the banks of Groton Bank. So all the residents there at that time, the structure was there as old colonial, and over time was modified throughout the years into the Victorian era. And it's the house is more of a Victorian theme to it now, but it had been there for quite a long time.
The last resident that lived there was Joe Kopp, and he was a bit OCD, and he had left it the way his parents had it when they were alive. So it is kind of like a type capsule of like pre-1930s, like everything that's in the home. So it's a lot of antiques, and everything has the feel of like, a lot of it is the Victorian stuff. I mean, there's a lot of neat things about their family too. There's a little an idol that one of the female, the lady who turned it into a Victorian, she liked to travel, and she ended up getting a little idol from an Egyptian tomb that she stole, and it is now like sitting in a case in the home. So there's like a lot of neat little things about the Kopp family.
Let's go ahead and take a listen to the first EVP. We're going to play that three times so that our listeners can hear it really well. Let's take a listen to the raw EVP.
Did you have to leave because of the famine? Great hunger. sad.
Yeah, sad.
Did you have to leave because of the famine? The great hunger? What was that?
Yeah, sad.
Did you have to leave because of the famine? The great hunger? What was that?
Yeah, sad.
Now, what is the entity saying?
I'll articulate and just give you a little more background. We were actually up in the servants' quarters, and during that period of time, that place was predominantly occupied by Irish immigrants, and it had to come up, and we started leading up to this. We tailored our response and focused on maybe on period questions of the time period they were there during the mid-1800s, and they had immigrated to America during the potato famine. So that's explains the phrasing of the question. To answer your question, I think it may be hard to hear, but I think it's actually saying I, like,
that's
acknowledge. That's
exactly what I got. Now, we here at Nightcast have amplified or enhanced just that portion. Let's take a quick listen to that. We'll play that again three times. You can definitely hear him saying I. Seamus, Stephanie, we have to have you hold right there while we take a break. When we return, we'll hear more EVPs collected by the Thames Society of Paranormal Investigation. I'm Ian Morris. Stay with us.
Be sure to visit the website at radiob88.com. This is Nightcast.
Step into the night every night on Nightcast at Radio B88, the talk of the Pacific.
This is Nightcast. I'm Ian Morris. Find out what's happening in our region of the world. Tune in to Midday Pacific at 12 noon on your local 3N network station. And if you're not a night owl staying up with us all night and you have something on your mind, you can phone in to Oceania Talk at 2 p.m. every weekday on your local 3N network station. Our guests joining us this evening from Connecticut, Seamus Denniston and Stephanie Sutera of the Thames Society of Paranormal Investigations. Seamus, Stephanie, what sites are the most active?
I do think that theaters are particularly haunted because of, like I said before, all of that wonderful emotion. I'm a singer, so I understand like how much you're giving to put on a performance. And I can only imagine how many impressions in time that I've created doing my performances and where I will be after I'm long gone. But I think that any place that brings great enjoyment could be a place that is particularly active, but also places that have had great sadness and torment, like we were saying earlier, the Battle of Groton Heights, which is more of a massacre rather than a battle. There were a lot of British soldiers that kind of stormed the fort by surprise, and there were not, I think it was like 400 British soldiers, and there were only about 80 American ones. So, I mean, they kind of, you know, they stomped us really, really good. So a lot of people died that day. And then there's so many other battles too that took place in our area, and There's a lot of Native American, you know, history that's in Connecticut. So, you know, this was all Native American land before, you know, the white man got here. So there's a lot of that going on, too. But I just think, you know, anything that any type of event that created a lot of emotion can create that.
Just to add to that, I think environmental conditions. So I find places with close to a source of water, which is a conductor of energy. And there's certain types of structural materials that if a location is made of, like, let's say, granite and limestone and things like that, they tend to hold on to energy. So those places I find in our research, they tend to be more active than other places.
Seamus, is there any particular hour in which paranormal activity is found to be more active? Any particular time or hour?
I would say it's more reported in the evening, and there's a couple of reasons for that. And I would say that's because when people are witnessing the phenomenon, typically people have day jobs, most people, and they're home to witness it. Doesn't mean this stuff is not going on when they're not home or things like that. But I tend, during the investigations, typically we conduct them the evening and a lot of times overnight hours. I find the times to be the most active is usually between like one and four, usually sometimes midnight. But other than that, I wouldn't say it's exclusive to those hours. It just tends to be the times that we capture the most evidence. But I don't know if that's just because we're just doing the investigations at those times. I think I've only done one or two cases where I've actually done it in the afternoon, and one case had nothing and another case had something. So I wouldn't say it's exclusive.
What tangible evidence do you look for and collect?
Well, obviously we look for something. The two main ones, people want to see it and people want to hear it. So those are the two things that we ultimately try to capture that's tangible that you can show someone.
I mean, we are also looking for readings and things like that, and we are also looking for information from our sensitives to correlate with our evidence, but that's not something, there's a lot of things that we consider as experimental, so we're in the process of testing it, because isn't that what every scientist does? I mean, you're taking observations of your environments and basing all of your theories off logic and putting pieces together, and that's kind of like what we're doing.
Well, Seamus, Stephanie, what investigation made you feel the most ill at ease?
Personally, I feel we had a home case in Springfield, Massachusetts, and that one made me feel the most uneasy. And that ended up, I would say, is more malevolent presence at that location. Yeah, I didn't feel good about that at all. Yeah, we're hearing growling noises of the snow animals in the home. Children's voices, and just hearing children's voices, disembodied voices, it's just disturbing to me. And it was just so active. And right before we had arrived at the location, the client was pushed over in the bathroom. It was just a bad situation. And the whole investigation, you just had this uneasy feeling that you're unwanted and you weren't wanted there. And anytime activity was occurring, and it was occurring frequently, it just made you feel like you didn't want to stay in the house too long. You had to take a breather quite frequently for that.
Yeah, the funny thing is, I was going to say the exact same place.
Yeah.
Both have the same place made you feel the most ill at ease. Well, do entities follow people from house to house?
Oh, most definitely. It's a possibility. Yeah. They've followed a couple of our investigators before. So that is most certainly something that can happen, being attached to a specific individual. I was just talking to a friend of mine. It doesn't have to do with an investigation, but his grandmother is, you know, he lives in the house with his grandmother, but her grandmother has been seen in their house, and she's from Germany. And they believe that she came over to be with her granddaughter and is in the home. They haven't had any activity in a few years. We've been trying to talk about like what maybe calmed everything down and why there's not anything going on. But I thought that was very fascinating. I mean, it went all the way on the other side of the pond just to, you know, be with your granddaughter who moved from Germany to America. That's fantastic.
Well, have either of you ever experienced a harsh physical activity such as a push while investigating?
Oh, yeah. I've actually been scratched before.
You've been scratched?
Yeah, I've been scratched. And it started out, and the more I do this, the more I talk to other people that have experienced these type of things. It was like a burning sensation right before, like extreme heat, and on my arm, my upper arm. Yeah, and then all of a sudden a scratch appeared. It definitely, yeah. So that I would say that was, we've been like kind of pushed and things like that. We talked about, Steffi's been had her hair pulled and things like that. We had one case. It was at a theater that we frequent on a college campus. We have exclusive access to it. The downstairs area and the dressing room seems to be active, particularly towards females. So the females of one investigation were groped on their legs. It was summertime and they were wearing shorts and parts of their legs and their, maybe areas that ladies don't like to be touched without permission were being touched. And that, so I think as well as injuring us, it's being pushed and stuff like that. They can be intrusive like that where,
well, Seamus, Stephanie, yes. Let's get to the next EVP that you have brought us. It's the Connecticut Local Theater, The Singing Man. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, that particular theater, it's a small theater. This is a different theater now on a college campus, the other one I was talking about. It's been around a long time, at least 50 years. It's been around. It's housed everyone. It's had Billy Joel play there. But it's kind of prestigious in its own right. But this, the particular stories associated with, there was a benefactor to the theater department there. There's been witness sitting in the audience in the upper tier. And there was also a report in a recent death, well, recent for us as far as history wise, about 10, 15 years ago, a professor had passed away after giving a seminar on the stage and dropped out of a massive heart attack. So over the years, we've had a lot of reports of activity in that theater. And so this is where this EVP was captured.
Well, let's take a listen to it. We're going to play it three times for our listeners. And let's take a listen to it now.
What are you talking about?
Oh, it just was at a 0.3. It just was at a 0.3.
What are you talking about?
Oh, it just was at a 0.3.
And you say that he was singing?
It sounds like he was singing. I think I can make out some words. I think he's saying something. It sounds like lyrics like "Don't be sad," or something like that.
Very good.
That's what I think he's saying.
Well, we have enhanced it, so let's take a listen to our enhancement of The Singing Man. And Seamus, what do you say that he's saying?
He could be saying like "Don't be sad." Don't be sad. Or something. I don't know. I don't mean to sing.
No, but that sounds it sounds very good.
It's like a sing-song type thing.
Yes, it is. It is. It's very interesting. Well, Seamus, Stephanie, we have to step aside for another break. When we return, we'll ask Seamus and Stephanie more about the haunts they have investigated and listen to more EVPs. We'll let the ghost singer take us into the break. I'm Ian Morris. We'll be right back.
This is Nightcast.
Thank you.
We're back from break. Welcome back. This is Nightcast. I'm Ian Morris. Never miss another show. Become a Nightcaster by going to the Nightcast page at RadioB88.com. And as a special Nightcaster, you'll always be informed of new and upcoming Nightcast shows. Our guest this evening, joining us from Connecticut, Seamus Denniston and Stephanie Sutera of the Thames Society of Paranormal Investigations. Seamus, tell us about the most haunted location your group has investigated.
Well, there's one particular location that we go back and are fortunate enough, because I actually work on a college campus. So I have a good rapport with the college, and there's two or three sites that we tend to go back to. But there's one particular theater that we visit a lot, and it's Tansel Theater. And the reason I do that, and we don't have any clients, well, ongoing one with the theater department, we always divulge what we find, but they allow me access whenever it's not in use. And I'm fortunate enough to have an opportunity to investigate a place like that because it's active. And it's a place that I get to use if we bring new team members in. It's a great place to train them because things happen so frequently. So I would say that is probably the most haunted place. We've done at least, I think, 8 or 9 investigations of the place right now. Yeah, it's just everything from visual phenomenon to disembodied voices, and captured numerous EVPs from there, and all kinds of things have happened there. We've been touched, and so it's just a great place overall to investigate.
Now, have entities ever followed you home?
It's possible.
It has not happened to me, and it's not happened to Seamus, but or two of our investigators, Emma Martinez and Marilyn Marin, have said that they have had activity after investigations.
And how did they get rid of them?
Well, I'm not sure about Emma. I haven't spoken to her about that, but Marilyn she ended up saging her house to do a clearing. So, and then the activity kind of dissipated. But I also find with Emma, they sort of gravitate to her for help because she's our medium, and she's, you know, she sees things clear, a lot more clear than the rest of us. So I imagine that is the reason why they follow her home.
Do objects hold entities or spirits?
No, I'm still on the fence about that. I think the spirits may be attached to a particular object. But as far as, you know, we've all seen things on the internet, you know, ghosts in a bottle or haunted dolls and things like that, because people have that firm belief.
Some people is actually trapped within it, or we're more thinking that it's kind of attached to the object itself, that it is free to leave, but it is kind of focused on that particular object and will go with it. But I don't think there's anything that's like a, you know, genie in a bottle or ghost in a bottle type thing where it cannot leave. But I mean, that's just something we have not come across, so that's why I'd be on the fence.
Well, are most problem spirits evil?
I wouldn't say evil. Probably not the right word. I think as paranormal investigators, I think it's misconstrued. A lot of cases, people automatically assume and label them negative entities or demons or whatever have you. That's very few and rare, I think. But I think, like you may have asked me before, I really kind of think it's sometimes spirits that have a lot of energy or mischievous and things like that, and can be misconstrued as aggressive or malicious just because they're just trying to make contact with the living for whatever reason.
Well, does your group perform resolution, or do you just stick to investigation and verification?
We get involved in the resolution part. Like I said, that was one of the things that bothered me before, that teams weren't doing, that I was associated with. I'm not saying every team's like that, but the teams I was associated with prior were not doing the follow-up. Sometimes all it's needed with the client is to verify what's going on and kind of explain and educate them on what exactly is going on, and that usually resolves the problem.
But we also do provide them with options on where to go to from there. I mean, sort of looking at maybe to see if they have some religious affiliation, and then we have affiliates that we deal with and that we trust that we can kind of send them to so they can help them. So we're providing them with information, and then we're also, you know, about what is going on in their home, but we're also providing them with information like with their next step. Like, what do you want to do? Do you want to get your home cleared? Are you okay with it? Did you just want to kind of understand what's going on in your home, and that made you, kind of more at ease, or are you interested in sort of not, do you not want any activity in your home? Because there is always a level of fear too with each, for the residential cases, in each family. I mean, sometimes there are families that just can't handle this. It's just not for them. It's too much. And then there are others who, when they find out, they're okay with it. They're like, well, okay, they can be part of our family, and we understand that they need a place to be. So it's all kind of depending case, like on each case.
So what is the difference then between a ghost hunter and a ghost resolutionist?
Well, I feel like, I don't know, sometimes the ghost hunter is sort of affiliated with people who break into abandoned buildings or kind of sneak on property they shouldn't be on and don't have any structure to what they do. So if you mean ghost hunter like that, like paranormal investigator is kind of a little more formal. Like we go into it with a little, you know, like a scientific base and try to keep things a lot more controlled, and we're very professional about what we do. But I think that people who are going to come in there are probably going to try to recreate what we have found, somebody who's a, you know, a paranormal resolutionist. So they are also going to do the same, some of the same things, but they are really just finding like the end for everyone, like something that everybody is going to feel comfortable with. So it depends on who we're talking about here too, because there are different, you know, in each religion too, there's like some sort of like okayness with ghosts or not okayness with the spiritual world. And so there's kind of, you're tiptoeing around sort of, again, that's the particular case that you're working with.
Well, Seamus, yes. Stephanie, let's get to our final EVP for the evening. Okay. Can you tell us, go ahead and set it up for us, the Mother Bailey House?
Well, I really love Mother Bailey. I mean, her name is Anna Warner Bailey. She's considered one of the daughters of the Revolution, and she's got a few great stories that are kind of tied in with her. Like when she was young, she ended up, her uncle was wounded in one of the battles, and she ended up finding him and he was dying, and she came and found her aunt that she was living with and their child, and they went to his side and to bring them over to his body so they could be with him in his last minutes. And I mean, this is when she was a little kid. And then when she was older, she had this great story about a petticoat. And what is so fantastic about this is how she became a daughter of the Revolution. There was a man, like a messenger, who was trying to get wadding that they used for the cannons over to a battle, but his shipment had gotten stolen. So he was kind of in distress in the street, being like, I don't have anything to give these soldiers for their cannons. All my stuff got stolen. I don't have anything. And she just, right in the middle of Thames Street, just took her petticoat off. And like in those days, like, you did not tell you wore a petticoat, let alone take it off in the middle of the street. But she was kind of revered as a hero, and her story like spread all over the nation. And she had like presidents come and visit her in the future and stuff. And she kind of became like this idol, and she, and that was the home that she lived in. And she also died in that home when she was an old woman. She fell asleep next to the fireplace and her dress caught on fire and she was burned. Luckily the house was not destroyed, but that had,
well, let's take a listen to the EVP.
You want to ask anything, Tim? How's George? Anna, how's George? You want to ask anything, Tim? How's George? Anna, how's George? You want to ask anything, Tim? How's George? Anna, how's George?
Let's take a quick listen to our enhanced or amplified version. Okay, what do you make of that?
I would qualify this, like we said, it's experimental. And just to clarify, it's electronic voice phenomena, but this was used during our using the experimental equipment, the ghost box or the spirit box, Frank's box, whatever you want to call it. At that point, people will say, well, it's some sort of frequency. It could be. But what we do when we operate that particular tool, we try to ask control questions. So there's only one correct answer. And we had proceeded to ask some control questions and we got validation. So then we started asking more in-depth questions. And you'll hear, he was actually a representative from the city where the Mother Bailey, because the city had owns the building. And he was asking House George, asking Anna George, it was a relative of hers. I guess, long story short, I think they're saying dead at least three or four times.
Yes. It sounds like, to me, what they're saying is, he's dead, man, dead.
Like, geez, guys, hello.
Let's take a listen. Let's take a listen. It sounds like he's saying, he's dead, man, dead.
Yep.
I love that last dead because it's just so clear. It's like, oh, wow.
Yes. It's
that was taken in the basement of the Mother Bailey home, which at one point was used as a tavern. So that was, there are several EVPs. Selections, audio clips that are on our website that, you know, and it gives you more backstory on the Mother Bailey house. And now, you can also re-listen to that too.
Now, Seamus, Stephanie, what would you tell a person who is being physically attacked by an entity? What should they do?
Well, first of all, if they're telling me that, I have to put them through the ringer, so to speak. I know they're going through a lot and they think they're being attacked by a spirit, but I got to find out if you're in your right frame of mind. I mean, someone usually, we go from zero to being attacked by a ghost. And usually there's usually some steps that lead up to you being attacked by a ghost. It just doesn't happen randomly. So we really do have to qualify the client and see what's going on with their life and things like that. And then we can more or less try to help them and maybe give them some advice and see if I can make some referrals for them. If they already think they're being attacked by a ghost, I don't think an investigation is going to do a lot of good for me. For us and benefit them at all.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Seamus, Stephanie, does the Thames Society of Paranormal Investigations have a website?
Yes, we do. You can find our website at tspiparanormal.com.
And where can our listeners find and see more of your investigations?
Well, you can go on our website, and we do have an investigation gallery. And you can also find us on YouTube, where you can see some of our radio shows and find a couple of our, there's some investigation clips. But we are going to be launching a web series about our investigations soon. That'll be coming out in the next few months. So that's just plug in Thames Society of Paranormal Investigations into YouTube, and you can find us there. But we are also located on Facebook. We have a fan page, and then we have a group page for community to post anything about the paranormal that they like. And, you know, you can have some funny memes or, you know, promote your own shows or your own paranormal investigation teams. And that can be found at TSPI The Revenant Review on Facebook. But we're on Twitter, TSBI Paranormal is our handle there, and you can find us on Google Plus as well. And I mean, we're all over the place, you can find us. But we have, our email is tspiparanormal@gmail.com, and if you want, you can call us on our hotline if you have any questions at 920-940-TSPI.
And if our listeners can't remember where to find the information for the Thames Society of Paranormal Investigations, you can always go on the Radio B88.com website, go to the Nightcast page. At the bottom, you'll see a menu that says Nightcast Shows. Click on that, and you'll see the show listed for tonight with the Thames Society of Paranormal Investigations. You'll also see links to their Facebook page, their Twitter page, and their website. Make sure you go on Facebook and like them, follow them on Twitter, and make sure you check out their website. It's really incredible. Seamus, Stephanie, our time is up for this evening, and we'd like to thank you both for being our guests on Nightcast.
Thank you. It's been a blast.
Thank you. We'd love to come back anytime.
You're always welcome back. And we want to thank all of our Nightcasters for joining us once again. Until next time, keep your minds open, listen and look for those on the other side. I'm Ian Morris. Have a good night, everyone.
This has been Nightcast. Be sure to visit the website at radiob88.com.
Overnight Pacific News is up next on your local 3N network station.
Radio B88. Three N Network.